represent an act that no other performer has ever dared to execute. In fairness, I must warn those with weak constitutions to leave the theater for this performance. Lights? Thank you. Some appropriate music, maestro? Thank you.
The immodest Daffy Duck was one of the stars of the Warner Brothers cartoons. Warner Brothers Animation specialized in irreverent comedy. Their celebrity roster also included Bugs Bunny, Porky Pig, Elmer Fudd, Sylvester the Cat, Tweety Bird, Pepe Le Pew, Yosemite Sam, Foghorn Leghorn, Wile E. Coyote, and the Roadrunner. In the 1930s and 40s, audiences saw the Warners' Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies at movie theaters. In the 1950s and 60s, children grew up with them on TV. My guest Steve Schneider is the author of That's All Folks, A History of the Warner Brothers Cartoon Stars and the Writers, Animators, and Actors Who Created Them. Schneider has written about animation for the New York Times and the Village Voice and is a former TV columnist for the Times. In 1985, he was the guest curator for an exhibition saluting the Warner Brothers Animation Studio at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Schneider told me what makes the Warner Brothers cartoons different from the rest.
Well, both specifically and in general, I think it's a spirit of irreverence. The Warner Studio sort of hit its glory after the Disney Studio had been established. And if you know, Disney is sort of saccharine and storybooks and fairy tale lands, and things are always rounded and cutened and so on. Warner's was a very direct sense of reaction to that. The studio never had the kinds of physical resources that the Disney shop did in terms of the amount of money or the amount of time that they could devote to their films. And not only that, the Warner Studio, the live-action divisions, was the site of where Bogart and Cagney were making their great movies in the 30s and 40s. So what the Warner cartoonists were virtually forced to do was to come up with cleverer or wittier films, and also they sort of kept within the signature style of the studio by making it this kind of street-smart and snappy kind of humor. In particular, they almost were virtually thumbing their nose at the Disney traditions throughout. The way they played with film forms, the way the characters were kind of, again, street smart.
Urban and ethnic, it seemed, too, that there was always an urban ethnic streak to the character.
Exactly. In particular, as a good example, there's a Disney cartoon which is called Lullaby Land, which seems to sort of sum up the Disney sensibility. That's from the 1930s. Well, by the 1940s, the Warner folks could release a film called Bowery Bugs. And it's much a good encapsulation of the difference between the two.
Well, let's look at some of the stars of the Warner Brothers cartoons and go through their characterizations and who developed them and how they changed over the years. Why don't we start with the first big star of this particular group of cartoons, and that's Porky Pig. Now, he made his debut in 1935 in a cartoon that was directed by Fritz Fehling called I Haven't Got a Hat. And I want to play a short clip of this, and our listeners who know Porky Pig will see how different the character was, will hear how different the character was when he was originated. And in this, he's like a school kid, fat, self-conscious, with a stutter. And here he is in school, and by the way, the teacher is a cow.
We will now open our exercises with a recitation by our little friend, Porky Pig.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear the midnight ride of Paul Revere.
That's almost uncomfortable to listen to. It sounds like a real stutter.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it was. Porky came along as part of a whole group of schoolroom characters. He was not intended to be the bearer of this great star await, you know. And the first voice that they got for it was a man by the name of Joe Dougherty. This is during the days before Mel Blanc, who's synonymous with so many of the Warner voices, had come in. In order to give the character a kind of distinctiveness, director Freeling had a character actor named Dougherty come and do the voice. Well, in fact, he had a genuine stutter. And eventually that became such a problem, because they would take so much time in recording the things, he couldn't control his delivery at all. He would get stuck on words and they'd have to do take after take after take. Finally, they canned him, and they had Mel Blanc come in and devise a more caricatured version of what a pig's delivery would be. And in fact, I agree with you. the early versions of Porky, the voice is almost painful to listen to because you really get a sense of the poor fellow suffering there.
Yeah, and in the cartoon, he's sweating bullets.
Exactly.
So as the voice changed, how did the characterization of Porky Pig change?
Well, the Warner folks, the cartoonists, were actually a bit surprised when they finally came up with a character that caught on in any kind of massive way. So they retooled the character virtually from cartoon to cartoon. He would change his entire appearance and even his entire identity, not only changing roles from film to film, but he would be an adult, he'd be an infant, he'd be a farmer, he'd be a city slicker. It would all be changed. Finally, I think he hit his kind of classic form around 1937 when a director named Bob Clampett took over one of the units there. There were usually three or four separate units making cartoons in tandem at Warner Brothers. And Clampett had an early assignment for working with Porky and the Looney Tunes. He redesigned the character quite attractively, I believe, and also worked with Mel Blanc to come up with a voice which was humorous rather than agonizing.
How was it Porky Pig who got to do That's All Folks? How did he get the assignment?
Well, a variation...
And I should say That's All Folks is the verbal logo that ended all the Looney Tunes.
Right. A variation on that began as early as the audition reel that the early Warner cartoonists put together in 1929. That very first reel, which was never released to the public, ended with a character saying, "So long, folks." And that just metamorphosed over the course of years. And when Porky became popular, especially with his very, very distinctive vocal sonority, they just assumed it was a catchy and memorable way to end the films.
Well, Porky Pig was eventually eclipsed by some of his co-stars, and you point out in your new book that each new star debuted as a supporting character, and that's how Daffy Duck got his start. He got his start as a supporting character in a Porky Pig cartoon. So why don't we look at Daffy Duck next? And my guest, by the way, is Steve Schneider, author of the new book, That's All Folks, The Art of Warner Brothers Animation. Let's introduce Daffy Duck by listening to his voice, and this is from a 1946 cartoon called Daffy Doodles. And in this cartoon, Daffy Duck has taken on the fiendish mission of drawing mustaches on every billboard in town.
We've all got a mission in life. We get into different ruts. Some are the cogs on the wheels. Others are just plain nuts. I'm just wild about Harry, and Harry's wild about me. Science is some folks' calling. Others pilot a ship. Mission in life stated simply is a mustache on every lip.
I have to tell you, Daffy Duck was always one of my favorite characters. He was such the con artist and such the always bluffing his way through everything.
Exactly. I mean, he began really as the flightiest and the kind of most footloose of them all, but gradually became more inwardly directed. He was a creature really responding to a kind of set of neuroses which was unused to being present in animated cartoons. I mean, he became self-serving and greedy and egotistical at the same time as he would always set himself up for failure. And again, as in, I think, the Roadrunner cartoons, which came later, it's a relationship between desire and failure that motivates so many of the Warner comic underdogs, like the Coyote and also Daffy Duck. Daffy, I think, had about the most protean existence of all the characters there. For some reason, most of the directors, certainly all of the stronger directors, Tex Avery, Bob Clampett, Chuck Jones, a couple of the others, found in Daffy, I think, perhaps their most receptive vehicle. They would refashion him virtually from picture to picture, and he became perhaps the strongest statement of their individual temperaments as filmmakers. He was uncontrollably flighty, say, in Tex Avery's films. Then when Bob Clampett came along, he became just almost a volcano of energy, which is the way that Clampett handled a lot of his films.
Do you know how Mel Blanc developed the sputtering voice for him?
Well, one story has it that it was actually a takeoff of boss Leon Schlesinger's speech. Schlesinger had a lisp, and they were trying to come up with some kind of way to add a little bit of a zing to this otherwise, you know, anonymous duck at the point. And someone suggested that they impersonate Schlesinger's voice. And they did that very early on, and Daffy's duck, Daffy's voice, like many of the others, was sped. So the lisp there, the sputter actually was engendered by Schlesinger's lisp. And then, according to legend, when Schlesinger first heard the Daffy voice, he fell on the floor loving it and not knowing the fact it was a gentle piece of ridicule against Mr. Big there. So.
Now, Daffy Duck in many cartoons was hunted by Elmer Fudd. That was also the fate of Bugs Bunny. Bugs Bunny was also hunted by Elmer Fudd. Elmer Fudd was not very bright, always getting conned by Bugs and Daffy. Let's hear a clip of Elmer Fudd's voice. And this is from a 1952 cartoon called Rabbit Seasoning.
It's wabbit season. Oh, boy, wabbit twax. Oh, White Wabbit, I know you're there. If you're not out in 10 seconds, I'll blast you out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, Wabbit, now I got you.
What's up, Doc?
I'm hunting wabbits. It's wabbit season.
The voice of Elmer Fudd is one of the few voices that wasn't done by Mel Blanc.
Yeah, in fact, it's the only really long-ranging voice that Mel didn't handle, outside of some of the female ones. It was done by a radio actor named Arthur Q. Bryan, who was a pudgy dumpling of a man, who was freelancing in radio in various and sundry capacities. And he had this voice, and this seemed to be the definitive milksop, you know, the all-purpose schmo that someone like Bugs Bunny could play off of. And so they seized upon it immediately.
I've always thought of Elmer Fudd as being the square in the cartoons. Also, the stupid authority figure. The authority figure who was always conned by the other characters.
Yeah, exactly. He's a kind of the all-purpose dimwit aggressor. You know, some people have, over the years, kind of raised some hackles about the allegedly violent content of these cartoons. And let's face it, Fudd might be an example of this because he's always coming after someone with a rifle, or at least in his most prototypical occasions. And if you think about it, in every single one of Warner cartoons, the aggressor is always the one who loses. I mean, it has a kind of anti-violent attitude in a strange sense. If you get too heavy, firstly, you're made to look ridiculous because you're such a sap, in the case of Fudd, or so flustery and so blustery like Yosemite Sam. The morale here is that antagonism never pays off in these films. You always get your just desserts from someone who is sharper or wittier or more resourceful than you are.
The character of Elmer Fudd evolved from an earlier character called Egghead. Who was this character? I don't think I've ever seen any Egghead cartoons.
Yeah, Egghead crept around in about a half a dozen films in the late 30s. He was introduced in a Tex Avery cartoon called Egghead Rise Again, 1937. And he was a very, very highly caricatured kind of fellow with a big bulbous nose and a kind of sloshy voice. His voice often impersonated a very popular 30s comedian named Joe Penner. And his attire often was that of another nightclub comic named Ben Blue. But he was a little too bizarre to really catch take root, really, and you can actually see him almost metamorphose into Elmer in a film called Elmer's Candid Camera.
Let's move on to the Warner Brothers superstar, and that's Bugs Bunny, their great song and dance man. And to introduce the voice of Bugs Bunny, let's go to one of the great parodies of the Warner Brothers cartoons. This is a parody of Wagner's Ring Cycle. And this is called What's Opera, Doc? And the plot, of course, is Elmer Fudd hunting Bugs Bunny, but it's all done in opera.
Oh, mighty warrior of great fighting stock, might I inquire to ask him, what's up, Doc?
I'm going to kill the wabbit.
Oh, mighty hunter, twill be quite a task. How will you do it, might I inquire to ask?
I will do it with my spear and magic helmet.
Your spear and magic helmet?
Spear and magic helmet.
Magic helmet.
Magic helmet.
Magic helmet.
Bugs Bunny was really the great vaudevillian, the great opera star, the great song and dance man of the Warner Brothers cartoons. How did he get that kind of entertainment, Mr. Entertainment personality?
Well, I just think that he was a creature of infinite flexibility and essentially...
He was talented.
Yeah, I mean, before long, he was all bunnies to all people. Before long, they just had him do everything, and there was always a new context for him. I just think that his braggadocio or his shamelessness or just, you know, the brightness of his smile motivated the cartoonist to put him in these kinds of contexts.
It was funny, you know, I was watching a lot of the cartoons last night, and there were so many cartoons, including the one we just heard an excerpt of in which Bugs Bunny disguises himself by appearing in drag and trying to do the sexual tease on whichever hunter is hunting him.
Yeah, almost from his very first film, that's a bit of the bunny shtick. Again, it's because Well, as I mentioned, it's almost like he has no weight of a self. He can do virtually anything. He's quicker than Groucho and tougher than Cagney at the same time. And I think going in drag was, you know, the cartoons were always sort of ghettoized or never really considered mainstream artworks in their own way. And this way, at the very, very margins of the movie world, these guys were able to get away with some subversive images or ideas that were just neglected. The only way that it was possible is that these things were so ignored for so long that they carved out a little niche of freedom for themselves.
You have a great quote from Mel Blanc, who did the voice for Bugs Bunny. You say that, Mel Blanc says that he knew that Bugs Bunny was supposed to be a tough little stinker, so he gave him a combination of a Brooklyn and a Bronx accent, because he figured those were all the tough people he knew were from Brooklyn or the Bronx. Was Bugs Bunny always such the wise guy? Did he start off that way?
Well, in fact, the character did evolve, but rather gradually and rather subtly compared to some of the others. Very early on, he was quite clearly a sort of rabbit clone of Daffy Duck. In his first films, he would just madly hurl himself around a forest and put together all kinds of wisecracks and all kinds of other gambits which are largely unmotivated. A couple of years before the first Bugs cartoon, Daffy had come along and it caused a bit of an explosion in the theaters. Well, what do? Same thing in Hollywood these days, sequel mania. One of the directors there, he said he would just put a rabbit suit on that duck. And that, I think, might be the relationship between them. But then gradually, in 1940, Tex Avery directed a cartoon which I really think crystallized the Bugs character. That's called A Wild Hare. And all of this kind of scampering lunacy and the flightiness was shaved away. And he became someone who did virtually the opposite of overreacting to all situations. And no matter what his threat, he would always sort of stand there and stare someone down. He became a creature who initiated action rather than reacted to it, and established an almost immediate psychological control over his antagonists, no matter how much firepower they were pointing at him.
How did "What's up, Doc" become his motto?
A couple of theories on this. I think the most plausible one is it was just a phrase from Tex Avery's youth when he was growing up in Texas. They gave it to the character accidentally or randomly, and the reaction was so strong from that very first moment that they stuck with it. Again, Avery has a quote, and he said, "You know, audience were expecting the character to scream or do anything outside of come up with an understated remark, and then they said, 'Boy, we'll do that every chance we got,' and they did."
There were two different kinds of Warner Brothers cartoons. One was called The Merry Melodies, and the other was called Looney Tunes. What was the difference between each?
Well, they, in fact, were two separate series being produced by the same unit, as it were, way back when. But then the difference eventually folded. The Looney Tunes were the first series, begun in 1930 by the pioneering cartoonists at Warner Brothers. That's Hugh Harmon, Rudolph Ising, and Friz Freleng. And they originally starred a character called Bosco. These were in black and white cartoons and are not in very wide distribution these days. The Looney Tunes were so popular that Warner Brothers came to them and asked them to start a second series called The Merry Melodies. Warner Brothers was distributing these films, whereas Harmon and Ising, under producer Leon Schlesinger, were making them. Eventually, the Looney Tunes became the arena for the Warner's featured characters, Bosco, then when Bosco was out, replaced by Buddy, then eventually Porky Pig, who was the first Warner star known these days, became the star of the Looney Tunes series. The Merry Melodies were more specifically related to music. Each one of those early cartoons, again beginning in 1931, had to have a musical number in it that was based on music owned by Warner Brothers, either from one of its feature films or from one of its sheet music publishing concerns. And so for about 8 or 9 years, the Merry Melodies were explicitly musical films. They would have no continuing characters. These are all the cartoons with the singing bugs and the singing laundry and so on.
Yeah.
And those were also the first ones to be made in color with the Merry Melodies. Eventually, though, those distinctions were largely eroded. By around 1940, the Merry Melodies and the Looney Tunes were kind of interchangeable, although the last black and white films were the Looney Tunes, and they went as far forward as 1943. At 1943, the two series became indistinguishable. Star characters were in both series, and they just held on to the names out of the value of tradition, or to perhaps create an illusion that they had two separate series.
They each had different themes. Maybe we can play the music for each theme and you could tell us the origin of the theme. Let's start with the Merry Melodies theme. ¶¶ That's a re-recording of the theme that's available now on an anthology called TV Tunes. Where did the theme come from? Who chose it?
Okay, that was chosen by Warner Brothers cartoon music director, name of Carl Stalling. He joined the shop in 1936, and it's a piece called Merrily We Roll Along, which was a popular tune which had been featured in a movie around the time. Stalling also chose the theme for the Looney Tunes, which is called The Merry-Go-Round Broke Down. Stalling had been an early associate of Walt Disney back in Kansas City, where many of these cartoonists began. And he came to Hollywood on Disney's request, worked with Disney for a while on some of the first Silly Symphonies, knocked around a couple of other studios, then came to Warner Brothers, where he was their music director for about 22 years, did, to my mind, a series of brilliant scores, musical pastiches, which combine snatches of popular tunes and classical music, as well as snippets of his own compositions, as well as some original songs as well.
Let's listen to the theme that Stallings chose for the Looney Tunes. And this was originally a kind of jazz pop novelty tune called The Merry-Go-Round Broke Down. And this is, again, a re-recording of it. Those cartoons use such hip music.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Really, you know, Stalling also is being rediscovered by an entire generation of downtown New York avant-garde composers because of the syncopations of his music, mm-hmm. the evocativeness of the instrumentation, and just the entire very sort of rapidly cutting textures and things that he would put together to complement the action from scene to scene.
I think the great cartoon characters who we've been discussing kind of died out in the 60s?
Well, most of the Warner stars had their last releases in the 60s. Bugs Bunny's last cartoon was issued in 1964, when what is generally accepted to be the Warner cartoon shop closed down. It closed in about 1963.
Why did it close?
A variety of factors, almost all of them economic. The double feature had become a thing of the past in movie theaters, and cartoons like travelogues and newsreels were part of the fairly baroque film programs that used to lure people into theaters during all those years. The rise of television, which created a whole new market and a new aesthetic for animation, using limited animation and so on. And the fact that there was just very little marketing ability, I think, for these cartoons in theaters. They didn't think that they were economically worthwhile at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But then soon thereafter, the shop opened again. They changed gears, and the studio under DePatie Freeling Enterprises made a couple of dozen cartoons, mostly starring Daffy Duck and Speedy Gonzales. And then, lo and behold, in 1967, the studio, known corporately as Warner Brothers Cartoons, started up again. And that's when they introduced such characters as Cool Cat and Merlin the Magic Mouse. These were all for theatrical release again. And those finally breathed their last in 1969.
Do you think of cartoons as being the American pop form of surrealism?
Well, kind of in the same way that Bugs could go into drag because he was given a little bit of leeway being a sort of marginal figure, in the same way the cartoonist could also craft images that approach a kind of simple surrealism, yes. It is because they didn't have the rigid constraints of what I suppose could be considered Hollywood classicism to bind them down. You know, so many of the Hollywood movies fall into the same kinds of narrative tendencies with straightforward storylines and a simple three-act structure and so on. Well, the Warner cartoons, because they were comedic, because they were non-realistic, often played with time and with spatial images and with so on and so forth. So yeah, this was a tiny outpost of surrealism in mainstream American cinema.
How did you start taking cartoons seriously, studying them, I think collecting them as well?
Yeah, involuntarily. I had loved them as a kid and watched them quite relentlessly. Then I went through a latency phase when I thought I had outgrown these things. Then, back in 1975, there was a retrospective of the work of Warner Animation director Chuck Jones in New York. I attended it. and just got reacquainted with, well, it just confirmed what I had suspected that when I was younger, that in so many of the cases, these are masterly films, despite any qualifications, that they're supposed to be humorous, that they're supposed to be for kids. Well, that's all irrelevant. The artistry, and in many cases, the absolute brilliance of these films still speaks through to adult audiences. So I became reacquainted at a fairly august retrospective being held in New York in 1975.
What do you look to now for the future of cartoons?
Well, there are some interesting possibilities. I'm not quite as enthusiastic about computer animation as many people are, but I think with the advent of Roger Rabbit, which has been popular, kind of the classic forms might be rekindled. And also Warner Brothers, since 1969, has had a very, very capable and interested and caring man in charge of the cartoon division by the name of Ed Blyer, who's now the head of their television division. He has quite conscientiously and thoughtfully work with the artists who are still around and with the characters to be able to give them a new life, to in effect reinvent them for the 80s. And I think he's doing an admirable job with it.
Is there a cartoon that you saw a lot as a child that has always been among your favorites?
Absolutely, of course. It is called The Great Piggy Bank Robbery from 1946 by the brilliant Bob Clampett. It is the one where Daffy Duck conks himself on the head with an excess of enthusiasm after receiving his Dick Tracy comic book, and he hallucinates himself to be Duck Twacy, and then he encounters a slew of absolutely bizarro monsters in some of the most shocking and memorable scenes, I think, in all of movie history. That is a tremendous sentimental favorite. Another one is Chuck Jones's Duck Amuck, which came a little bit later, which is not as wild and woolly and anarchic as a Clampett film, but seems much more intellectual and disciplined. And if pressed, I would say that Duck Amuck is the finest one-reel film ever made of any kind, and I think it is a supportable argument.
Steve Schneider, thanks so much for talking with us about cartoons. Thank you.